uses to attack and decommission hospitals. And I think the film is the most pertinent at this moment in time, because this blueprint is being used right now across Gaza. However, it's not really under the limelight, and it's not as exposed as it was when Dr. Abu Safiya was in Kamal Adwan.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Dr. Azra Ziada, we thank you so much. London-based medical doctor, healthcare systems analyst, who's helped gather evidence of war crimes from Gaza and has been in touch with a network of doctors and healthcare workers in Gaza, including Dr. Abu Safiya. And thank you so much to Amel Guttatfi, who is the director of this documentary, The Disappearance of Dr. Abu Safiya, which is available online. We'll link to the whole documentary. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Nicole Salazar. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
On Saturday, September 20th, the Queen's Gaels hit the road once more to wage war in Waterloo. Will Alex Braken and this explosive Gales offense strike gold against the black and gold?
A totally tremendous touchdown!
Or will Quinton Springer and the Warriors run away with an upset victory?
OMG!
Tune in to CFRC 101.9 FM to find out. We'll be live at 12:45 with the Grad Club pregame show ahead of the scheduled 1 p.m. kickoff.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome, everyone. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario.
One voice message that I've gotten from a journalist in Gaza, like, if you could hear what people have said and what this means to them, like, that's worth more to me than anything I did with Reuters.
Whenever they present the reporting by Palestinian journalists, it always comes with a caveat, right? Like, we couldn't independently verify this or that,
right,
or this came from...
Palestinians are biased, we're not, right? Here in the
exactly.
West, like, people like me, we come with this open mind of unbiased neutrality, we see the facts and we tell people the truth, but no, in Palestine,
right,
they're compromised. There has to be a footnote and a caveat, and we can't rely on them to tell us what they're seeing with their
own eyes. And they're the ones seeing it, they're the ones living it, they're the ones experiencing it. You've been to Gaza. What was that experience like? Okay, so my next guest is Valerie Zink. For 8 years, she worked as a photojournalist for Reuters. But amid Israel's genocide in Gaza and the targeting of Palestinian journalists on the ground, she decided she could no longer stay silent. And so Valerie publicly resigned. She accused Reuters of enabling Israel's killing of Palestinian journalists in Gaza, pointing to the way the agency has repeated Israeli military talking points, including baseless claims about Al Jazeera's Enes Sharif, who was killed alongside five of his colleagues in Gaza City. Days later, five more journalists, including a Reuters cameraman, Hossam al-Masri, as well as my colleagues at Middle East Eye, Mohammed Salama and Ahmed Abu-Aziz, were killed in an Israeli double-tap strike on Nasser Hospital. For Zink, that was the final straw. And that's exactly what we're going to speak to her about. My name is Mohammed Hashim, and this is Real Talk. And she's here, Valerie Zink. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on Real Talk.
Thanks so much for having me, Mohand. I really appreciate it.
No, I appreciate you and I appreciate your time. But where, Valerie, do I even start? I mean, there's a lot for me that I can ask right now, but let me just quickly kind of gather your reflections upon this moment over the last, you know, week or so since everything have kind of developed for you since you posted that your the picture of you quitting and your decision to resign Reuters with the picture of you cutting the press card in half, the Reuters press card. How you been processing all of this?
I mean, I certainly wasn't prepared for the response that it's had. I mean, I thought that I would post it to my few hundred friends on Facebook and that would kind of be the end of it. Yeah, I mean, certainly wasn't expecting the response from people in Palestine, from journalists in Palestine, thousands of messages. I think, to be honest, it just speaks to the level of abject abandonment that people are feeling right now, that this, what I consider a fairly insignificant act has had the meaning that it's had for people. I'm glad that it has, but it's definitely not anything that I anticipated and honestly makes me feel like it was long overdue. Mm-hmm.
Well, if I can even get a little, just to get your thoughts on this, because I was thinking about this before we started our interview. I mean, yesterday, at the time of us recording this, yesterday, the world's top Genocide Scholars Association says that, you know, they've said that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. And so as, you know, you kind of read this and you're like, okay, well, what else is left for Western media outlets and Western newsrooms to kind of take a more substantial stance and a more substantial stand, I should say, in the sense of like, you know, like there's very few stones left unturned at this point. And I still think we still hear the rhetoric that's coming out in the sense of, you know, genocide is still a controversial word, or, you know, the fact that we're waiting for some sort of the decision by the courts and before we kind of allude to it in that way or label it in that sense. So I don't know. What are your thoughts in terms of where Western newsrooms are right now?
I mean, I think that there are shifts, certainly, that I see in Canadian media. It's gotten, there's a change. I mean, it's not enough of a change, and it's 2 years too late. I mean, it's decades too late, depending on how you look at it. But there is a shift there now that I think that the genocide is undeniable. And I think the, you know, forced starvation in particular has really impacted. I mean, I just see it in my day-to-day life. The people who've never brought this up in conversation with me before are impacted by this in a way that they haven't been. So, I mean, there's a bit of a shift, but, you know, not enough. We're still seeing the same headlines that are essentially, you know, following this template of Israel fabricates a lie to justify its latest war crime or crime against humanity, and that's picked up as a headline, or a euphemism, like we're continuing to see, you know, relocation of people in Gaza to another country, you know, these terms, this language that makes it seem like, you know, perfectly normal, appropriate, or inevitable. We're still seeing that. And I mean, what will it take? I mean, there's nothing left. I agree with you. There's nothing left. I think I've felt that way for a long time now. We, you know, it feels like every day is the most, you know, like the heights of depravity are, you know, more than I could have ever imagined possible. And then you wake up the next day and it keeps getting worse, right? Beyond what I could have ever conceived of. And, you know, I was listening to a friend of mine interviewed yesterday talking about Israel's innovation and depravity, right? Israel prides itself as this tech innovator and, you know, medical technology and all that. But I think what it's going to be remembered is the innovation in depravity, you know, the things that we could have never conceived of, like, you know, baiting starving kids with flour and like sniping them in the head, you know, or like using recordings of toddlers crying and in distress to bait people out of their homes. Like this, you know, if that's not enough, I mean, yeah, like I literally can't conceive of what is left at this point.
And if we were to kind of go back to your decision to publicly resign in the way that you did, you know, was there a moment, and obviously we're talking about a period of 2 years here, but when did you come to that decision? When did you feel like, was there a specific moment? I know you mentioned the killing of Anas Sharif in your statement, but how were you coming to terms with that decision? Was it just slowly leading up to it? Was it just the news of, let's use Anas for example, was it the news of Anas's killing as the breaking point? How what was your thinking process throughout all this?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the short answer is that was the breaking point for me. It's something that I've thought about a number of times. But just as far as context, you know, I mean, I've been involved in different ways in the movement for the liberation of Palestine for a long time now. I'm not unbiased. I don't subscribe to the idea of journalistic neutrality. I have an opinion about genocide. I have an opinion about occupation.
Can I say why do you think that that's important? Because this is actually an important note. Why do you feel the need that I don't subscribe to the idea of journalistic neutrality? Why is this important right now?
Well, that prevails in, you know, mainstream Western media, right? That's the expectation. And I mean, on that note, actually, I used to work for Canadian Press briefly as a stringer as well. I just started in 2003, and I was contacted by my editors there, I think the first week of November in 2023, just a couple of weeks into the genocide after I'd been involved in a protest calling for a ceasefire. And they called me to say, it was kind of a series of phone calls going up the chain of command, basically telling me that it was a bad look for Canadian Press and that they wouldn't be giving me assignments indefinitely, right? Because I couldn't come to the work in an unbiased, even though I've never covered anything related to Palestine. I've never.
Right. You don't even cover the Middle East.
No. And people, you know, I hate to disappoint people because I think that there's this impression, in the thousands of messages that I've received over the last week, there's this impression that I was the person in the newsroom writing these headlines for writer, deeply immersed in its coverage of Gaza. And that's not the reality. I mean, I'm a nobody freelancer in Western Canada, you know, and
I mean, I wouldn't say nobody though, Valerie.
I mean, like in the hierarchy of writers, like, sure. You know, like I'm in dust, you know. That's fine. I mean, it's okay. I'm just being transparent about this, right? I've never had any connect, and I don't say that to absolve myself. It's just that's the fact. I've never been involved in any of their coverage of the Middle East. And what I do feels very far removed from that for the most part. And throughout these last 2 years, I've done everything that I know how on a grassroots level, to increase, like to mobilize pressure on the Canadian government for an arms embargo, to impose sanctions on Israel. I've been involved in divestment campaigns against Canadian banks investing in Israeli weapons manufacture. And, you know, that's kind of been my focus. And the Reuters thing was in the background. Like, I really need to just contact my editors and tell them where I'm at right now. But
So you attended a protest in November, and this is at a time when you had a job with Canadian Press. And
I was a stringer. So, to be clear, I was not an employee. I was a stringer.
A stringer is basically like a freelancer, right?
A freelancer, so it basically means that you're their person, you know, in southern Saskatchewan. If there's news in that area, you're the person that they go to cover that. But right. There's no,
and,
yeah.
And despite that, despite the fact that you weren't even staffed, they felt it was necessary to cut ties because you just attended a Gaza solidarity protest.
And I pushed them on it and I said, you know, can you share with me your policy around neutrality or can you share? And then they essentially said, well, you're not an employee, so that doesn't apply to you.
Can I ask you this?
Am I being held to a higher standard than your employees? But they, you know, they didn't want to share with me any. It was just kind of, no, you're, you know. They said we won't contact you indefinitely. And that's been the case. And I'm fine with that. I don't want to work for anyone who has a problem with me opposing genocide. You know, I mean, it wasn't, people said like, oh, this must be a hard decision. These are not hard decisions. It's, you know, it's good riddance as far as I'm concerned.
Can I ask you this though, Valerie, because let me try to ask you this differently. And I don't know if this has happened to you or any other of your other colleagues at the time, but had you had attended, let's say, a protest in solidarity with Ukraine, do you think Canadian Press's decision would have been the same?
Well, we know the answer to that. And I asked them that on the phone that day. I said, so, you know, if I had been at a rally in support of housing for all, you know, would that mean that I couldn't work for Canadian Press? And they said, yes, you know, I mean, give me a break. We all know that that's not the case, right? And this is the double standard that's applied across the board. You know, I have friends who work in the library system in Vancouver where they've banned staff from wearing keffiyehs, wearing watermelons, like any, you know, Palestinian iconography at all. And the policy is, you know, we don't allow political symbols. But if you wear, you know, a pride flag, if you wear an Every Child Matters pin, you know, if you wear a Ukrainian flag, of course, those are all permitted, right? It's really what the policy means is you can't show support for Palestine or Zionists will feel unsafe in the library, right? So, yeah, I mean, that's the Canadian press story. It's a brief one, but that's part of the context.
Yeah. And even to even add to that, Valerie, yeah. as far as I know, like at CBC, for example, which is a Canadian public broadcaster, you can't even use the word Palestine. I think that's part of their guideline. Yeah, that's part of their style guide.
As far as I know, that's right. And I mean, CBC is obviously not alone in that. And there was actually a report released by Reuters staff and former staff a couple of weeks ago detailing some of the same sort of policies restricting use of the word Palestine, you know, the regulations around when and how they could use genocide and if, you know, cited in certain contexts and resources allocated to Israeli casualties. I mean, these are, I'm sure all of your listeners are familiar with all of this. But yeah, just going back to your question in terms of the breaking point, I mean, yeah, I had followed Anas throughout the genocide and, you know, kind of seen it coming, I guess, like a lot of us did after he posted that plea for protection from the international community. You know, we saw it coming. I mean, because we've seen this happen so many times before. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I develop a connection with these people and you're following them every day. You're seeing this through their eyes. And in my day-to-day life, you know, I go and get groceries. I drop my kids off at school or whatever. And I feel, for the most part, a profound alienation from all the people I interact with in my day-to-day life who are just in a different universe right now, right? Like we're not in the same place. And the people I feel connected to are, you know, on YouTube, they're doing podcasts, on Twitter. I feel like that's been my social world over these last 2 years, with some notable exceptions of close friends and family members and everything. But yeah, there's a, you know, I'm like with Abu Bakr, who you had on the show recently, like I feel like I love these people, you know, I do. And like, I have the utmost respect and admiration for them. Like, you know, I said in my statement that these are the best and the bravest journalists to ever live. And I mean, I think that's pretty indisputable personally at this point, but I also think it's true that they're just the best human beings. And, you know, when these assassinations happen, yes, it's killing eyewitnesses to the genocide, it's killing our right to know what's happening. It's also just erasing some of the best human beings, I think, that are alive on the planet, people who had a right to live, you know, and that's the part that I really grieve. And reading his final words and testament, I mean, like I was just weeping. I mean, I don't think I'm the only one. And I kept coming back. I think I've probably read it 15 or 20 times now. It's just, it's so devastating. And, you know, reading what he wrote about entrusting his kids and his, like, these are just beautiful people who deserve to parent their own children, you know, and it's unbearable. I mean, every day is unbearable, you know, and then you see Reuters headline, you know, I forget exactly what, like Israel's, they didn't say assassin.
I have it right here, actually. Basically, I think that the headline has changed now, but I have the original one it was published. And so it says, this was Reuters on August 10th, 2025. Israel kills Al Jazeera journalist, it says, was Hamas leader.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, you read Anas's final words and then you see this headline and my brain just can't contain these. Like it just breaks your mind, you know. And at that point I was done. Actually, I made the decision then, but I was visiting family and I didn't have my press pass with me and told my partner, when you come, can you please bring my press pass? And then I had to wait until he came because I knew, you know, what this is how the algorithms work. Like if anyone was going to see, you've got to have an image. And
it was super strong.
But that was the day I decided I'm going to cut it up and I'm going to do this publicly for whatever it's worth. I didn't think much, to be honest. But as a gesture of solidarity, you know, it's what I could do. And so I had to wait until my partner came with my press pass. And then just so happens, you know, then there's another five journalists assassinated at Nasser Hospital. And I'd been working on my statement at that point. And then that happened. And, you know, I knew I had to get it out. that day. So that was the breaking point. But, you know, it's in this it's in a bigger context, I guess. It's not that I, you know, had any illusions about Reuters coverage throughout the genocide. I mean, I'd been vocally critical about it throughout the genocide, you know, not just Reuters, but mainstream media generally. So it's, you know, it's not like 2 years into the genocide, I had this epiphany or something. I mean, it was a long time coming. It just felt that my work covering local stories here was far removed from it, and me leaving would not be noticed or have any impact. But yeah, I mean, just on principle, at a certain point, I just felt like I can never have anything to do with these people again. I mean, it's over.
And just on that, Valerie, basically the conversations that you were having with colleagues or upper management, or just, I'm not even talking about your decision to resign. I'm just talking about regular conversations over the past 2 years of the genocide. You know, I think a lot of the outrage towards mainstream media is the fact that this isn't, you know, very complicated, which, and the fact is, when you restrict the truth, or you restrict the reporting that's coming out of Gaza through the killing of journalists, the more the Israeli military can act with impunity. It's not hard to kind of look at it from that perspective. And so what were these topics part of the conversations that you were having with former colleagues, with managers, within the, you know, I know you weren't in the newsroom per se, but within the chats?
I basically don't have any Reuters colleagues where I live. You know, sure. I'm the only one in southern Saskatchewan. I was not in touch with management about this. I was talking to other journalists who work for other, you know, media organizations, trying to push them, you know, with varying degrees of success, I guess. And certainly there's no shortage of journalists who are furious right now, who feel, I mean, I can't count how many messages I've gotten from Reuters staff, from other journalists.
What did Reuters staff tell you? What did they say after you posted that?
A few messages from people who were very supportive and said, you know, one guy comes to mind who's working in the States and his visa is connected to his job with Reuters, and he hates it and he hates them and he wants to leave, but he can't leave without leaving the States and like aborting his entire life. And, you know, so there's obviously a lot of privilege that enabled me to make the decision that I did, and not everybody, you know, the sacrifices are different for different people depending on where they are and their circumstances. I'm part of this Facebook group called the Vulture Club that's basically people looking for fixers in different places. I posted it there when I shared it, to, you know, just initially, just like, oh, these are media people, journal, like, they may as well read it. And again, you know, mostly all entirely supportive. One senior, you know, veteran Reuters photographer who said, like, I'm sorry, Valerie, who, you know, that was his response.
Really?
And yeah. And like, you know, and I said, I'm not pretending to be anyone other than who I am, but
it's funny that that person was knocking you instead of looking at the stand.
He was knocking me, and he, you know, he said, we're all grieving, we're all outraged, but what you did was obscene. To, you know, accuse your Reuters colleagues. You know, I'm actually not, if you read the statement, I'm not actually accusing colleagues.
It's the organization.
This is about, you know, it's the organization. It's about editors and management, right? I'm not saying that, you know, journalists are trying their damnedest to make this better. And many of them are. And actually, I was contacted by a number of people who have quit their position, you know, with CNN and with CBC for the same reasons. And it, you know, for whatever reason, the algorithm didn't pick it up, right? But it's, I think, more common than we realize.
Yeah. And what do you think? I think for those who do stick with the organizations at the end of the day, I think there are basically two camps that I think of here. There's one camp, like, similar to the one that you just mentioned, where there, you have a colleague or a journalist who is very much against the policy of the organization, but their lives are tied to it because of, you know, whatever it is, a mortgage or a visa or whatever it is. And then there's others who, I don't know if that's more, I don't know if that's lessened over the last while, but then there's others who believe that they can have a shot at changing the policy from the inside by staying inside the organization. I don't know. What do you make of that?
Oh, I mean, it's the same. these are the same conversations that happen about, you know, people who run for office and think they can change things, you know, working in the system. I mean, this exists in all of these institutions, right? And I mean, that's never been my approach. I mean, I agree with the idea that ultimately it's a system that changes you, right? And that's what we see with journalists. That's what we see with elected officials. You know, by and large, there are some exceptions, but I mean, just look at the facts, right? It hasn't been successful, right? There are a few stories that get through. Usually then there's a retraction, you know, the Globe and Mail, the major daily here in Canada, just issued a retraction for using the term forced abortion. You saw that, right?
Yeah, actually,
because that would imply blame, right? That would be actually reporting on, you know, who has agency over this and the facts of the matter. But no, it's a humanitarian crisis. There are many factors. No, you know, there's no aggressor here. There's no one to point your finger to.
It was being reported that also Honest Reporting happened after basically a campaign from Honest Reporting, which many viewers may not know is basically a pro-Israel watchdog in Canada, similar to like Canary Mission and
Beitar. Yeah, I'm sure that there are equivalents in the States and elsewhere. I'm not familiar with what they are, but a friend of mine, Sean Tucker, has been doing a lot of work on Honest Reporting Canada. They have charitable status in Canada. They're a registered charity, incredibly, right? And essentially they incite campaigns of harassment and intimidation against journalists who run anything nominally critical of Israel, right? Who are then, you know, then they receive a deluge of thousands of threatening messages, messages threatening their personal safety, the safety of their family, you know, racist messages, just abusive, hateful, vitriol, to punish people, right? And then they, of course, contact their employers and you know, say that this person doesn't deserve to have this position, you know, and people are afraid for their livelihood. And it's effective. A lot of times it is, right? And people begin to self-censor. They take the path of least resistance. And then at the editorial level, you see these retractions and apologies and, you know, and this is all done through like publicly funded tax breaks in Canada, and many other Zionist organizations, you know, who are also in the same position of being registered as a charity, right, for public good, allegedly.
So you've spoken to me about the positive messages that you've received since posting your resignation. What about the negative ones? What negative ones have you received? What do you feel like you've been placed in a position that kind of jeopardizes your professional relationships?
You probably won't even believe me when I say this, but there's been essentially no negative message. I haven't read all the comments. There are thousands of comments on Twitter and Facebook, and I haven't actually read any of those. Maybe a smattering. I've tried to read all of the individual messages that people have sent me. For the most part, I've read all of them and responded as best as I could. So I don't know what's in the comments, I'm sure. I've seen a few that are, you know, along the lines of, oh, you know, good, one less, you know, pro-Hamas journalist, that kind of thing. But I haven't received any negative messages personally, other than some really patronizing sort of, I know this war is brutal, Valerie, and wars are brutal, but these Hamas people are not your friends. And, you know, there's this kind of, oh, you must be naive and let me inform you of the reality of how barbaric these people actually are. And, you know, you don't know what you're, you know. So some of that, but honestly, in the past 2+ decades of doing work around Palestine, I've received a lot more hateful messages than I have this last week. It's mostly been overwhelmingly positive.
In your statement, you talk about, you know, having deep shame and grief. And this is also comes at a time when a lot more journalists are being vocal right now, being basically deeply ashamed of the profession right now, in light of this. So how do you look at journalism? And when I say journalism, I mean obviously reporting within Western media outlets, mainstream media outlets in the West, in 2025 right now.
I mean, for me personally, I was obviously willing to torch any future that I had working for Western media, right? I mean, that I did that with eyes wide open. I'm totally unemployable in, you know, mainstream media. That's fine. I mean, I think that one thing I will say is that alternative media has never been better. I think that people are abandoning mainstream media en masse. You know, like, I grew up in a CBC family, okay? Some of my earliest memories are of the family gathering before supper. It's golden hour. The sun's going down on the horizon. I grew up on a farm in rural Alberta. You know,
and Peter Bansbridge about to come on.
Yeah, right? And my dad is hushing me, you know, like, World at Six, like this was a sacred time in our household, right? The World at Six, right? And that was instilled in me. I've had CBC on in the background my whole adult life, despite myself, just out of force of habit, no matter how terrible it is. I've just, you know, I haven't been able to break the habit. It's just on, it's a comfort thing. But that's over now, right? Like, that was over October 8th. I don't have the stomach for it. And maybe you could argue, and people have argued this with me, you know, we have a responsibility to just know what they're saying, to be aware of it. I can't do it. I can't. I mean, and I don't think my parents don't listen to CBC either now, for what it's worth, right? And alternative media is shining. That's what I mostly am focused on right now is all the great work that's being done there. I mean, I'm not saying that they're thriving financially. I know it's always a struggle, and my inbox every day is filled with pleas for financial support from whatever alternative, you know, Patreon or whatever. It's a struggle. There's not a lot of models for how this can be financially, you know, viable long term. It's a struggle. But in terms of the content that they're producing right now and how many people are relying on that to know what's going on in the genocide, I mean, yeah, it's never been better, I think.
But why is it, if I can just kind of expand on this, why is it that you think that these newsrooms are still unable to fully stand in solidarity with their Palestinian colleagues? Like, we've seen strong calls, for example, of them calling for allowing international journalists to go in, international reporters to go into Gaza, which is obviously great. Nobody is going to deny that or want to stand against that, basically, in terms of that support. But you also see the same outlets, the same newsrooms who either collaborate with these Palestinian journalists whenever they present the reporting by Palestinian journalists, it always comes with a caveat, right? Like, we couldn't independently verify this or that,
right,
or this came from.
Palestinians are biased. We're not, right? Here in the
exactly.
West, like, people like me, we come with this open mind of unbiased neutrality. We see the facts and we tell people the truth, but no, in Palestine, right, they're compromised. There has to be a footnote and a caveat, and we can't rely on them to tell us what they're seeing with their
own
eyes.
And they're the ones seeing it, they're the ones living it, they're the ones experiencing it. So I guess that takes me back to my question is, what else is needed for newsrooms to have a stronger stand of solidarity, or why isn't even that stand isn't happening? Like, we understand where the problem is, right? And you highlighted it in your statement briefly, where you talk about peddling Israeli military talking points, right? I think you called it Israeli propaganda. But that's the problem with how media reporting is presented. But why can't they take a stronger stand in solidarity is what I'm asking here.
I mean, it's a good question. Like, I think that it would be foolish of us to think that these are anything other than, like, profit-driven capitalist organizations that care about a bottom line more than they care about individual people, right? And will that change with more pressure, more public outrage? It might, but I think the way that they're structured is, you know, they're not structured to care about individual people's lives, right? And that's been honestly the most heartbreaking part of this, is being contacted by the families of journalists who've been killed and talking about their experience, the families of Reuters journalists who've been killed, and how, like, their heartbreak, fury, again, I don't have the language for it, but the total disregard for their family members' lives, you know, and still until this day, right? I don't know if we can expect that to change, honestly.
Can I ask you this then, if we change gears a bit? You've been to Gaza, is that correct?
I have, 20 years ago, almost right. Exactly, yeah.
And you've been to the West Bank as well, but since we're talking about Gaza, what was that experience like?
Yeah, I was in the West Bank in 2003 and in Gaza and the West Bank in 2005. I was there volunteering as a medic with the Red Crescent. And, it was kind of a strange time, to be honest. It was right after the disengagement when all of the settlements were evacuated.
Right. It was before the blockade, the Israeli blockade.
Yeah, exactly. And so very different context than 2003 when I was in the West Bank at the height of the Intifada, with curfew.
The second
constantly
one.
Enclosure. Yeah, second Intifada. So a very different time. I was just thinking about it recently because someone contacted me from Gaza who was asking if I'd ever been there. And we were chatting. I said, I was there right after the disengagement. And he was talking about what a beautiful time that was because he was one of those kids who, looked out his window at the sea, could smell the sea in the air and was forbidden from ever going there. And he was telling me how he would go to sleep at night hearing settlers dancing and having parties on the beach. And one of the things that I did when I was in Gaza is work at these pop-up medical tents that the Red Crescent set up along the beach, because all these kids like him who had lived right, like a literal stone's throw from the sea their whole lives could finally access it for the first time and were just running into the water and didn't know how to swim. And there were all these problems with near drownings as kids were just, flooding into the sea. So, it was a different kind of experience than, being there a couple of years earlier. I felt pretty useless medically, to be totally honest, with very, very limited Arabic. I didn't feel terribly useful in that respect. In the West Bank, it's a bit different because just having a Canadian passport, it changes things, right, in terms of the ability of ambulances to get through checkpoints, the likelihood of them being targeted, just having a presence there. This was at the time when there were a lot of protests against the construction of the apartheid wall. I attended a lot of those. They were obviously, peaceful, unarmed protests that were met with live ammunition and violence, as is the case always. So I attended a lot of those demonstrations.
So how has that trip changed you, or what did you carry, what did you go away with basically when you came back to Canada or when you went back to Canada?
Honestly, rage. I got a lot of rage. I was there for 3 months, particularly in 2003, to be honest. So 3 months, it's enough time to really gain an appreciation of what it means day to day to live under occupation and the daily degradation and humiliation and violence that people live with filled me with rage. But also, it was life altering. It was formative for sure. And the relationships that I, left there with, are incredibly meaningful to me. And the way, I just felt like you see the absolute best and worst of humanity, right? And I think we're still seeing that now in the genocide, right? Like the way that Palestinians are in that, like the generosity, my God, like it was unbearable to me, you'd walk down the street and have, a dozen people inviting you in for dinner. And then you'd go and they cooked for 3 days and they would take, embroidery that they'd worked on for months and give it to you after knowing you for 10, like it was just excruciating generosity and kindness and beauty. And then you go to a checkpoint and I was just filled with rage. That's what I left with. I think that's probably stuck with me. I'm easily enraged. And just, I think, a sense of urgency. I don't know. It's hard to summarize, I guess.
No, it is. It is. And actually, thank you for delving into that. But let me ask you this then. If there was a journalist right now, basically, who was in the same shoes you were weeks ago, kind of on the fence, not knowing, you know, what decision to take. They feel outraged as you were, as you are right now, and they want to take some sort of stance, but they're also scared of making that jump or taking a drastic decision that would change their lives, perhaps. But what would you tell them if they were listening to you right now?
You know, honestly, I would say that, like, one voice message that I've gotten from a journalist in Gaza, like, if you could hear what people have said and what this means to them, like, that's worth more to me than anything I did with Reuters. Like, it, you know, it, what you gain from standing behind people and what that means to them, it's just, it wasn't a difficult decision for me. I guess I'll say it was the right decision, and that's been validated in how people have responded. I never would have anticipated what it's meant to people who are just desperate for anyone to do anything. And the level of exasperation and fury that people feel toward these media outlets now for their culpability in enabling this to continue and normalizing it, things that used to be shocking to us. You know, Israel used to have to lie, and now they just, yeah, we bombed a hospital, right? Like, we see how this has changed over the course of this year. What's acceptable now, right? And that's horrifying to me. And I think that that will permeate well beyond the boundaries of Palestine, right? That has implications in a much broader way. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I can't counsel anyone to torch their career or anything, but certainly in my experience, it's been profoundly humbling and rewarding to connect with all the people who've reached out to me over the past week.
Have any Palestinian, you said you got a voice note from Gaza, so have you been in touch with any Palestinian journalists? And I'm just curious of what you were telling them, what they were telling you, if that was the case.
Yeah, I have. I'm honestly kind of embarrassed to like, you know, to be thanked for my courage and brave, like, it's unbearable to me, right? From these people living, like, it's just, it's a joke, right? Nothing that I've done in my whole life is as brave as, you know, waking up and deciding to live another minute in Gaza right now, right? And all these people reaching out to me to thank me in the most sincere way, like using language that is, you know, more beautiful than anything I ever encounter in my day-to-day life here, right? I mean, like, the most eloquent messages. I don't know how to respond. I do my best to respond to people in a heartfelt way, but that's been most of it, is just people thanking me. I guess the other side of it is, you know, the number of people who are asking for my help in ways that, unfortunately, like, just don't have the power to, like, you know, help if journalists who want my help evacuating right now, or families of journalists who've been killed who are trying to connect with families living overseas and evacuate to join my cousins or uncles in the UK or whatever. Like, this, that's been the hardest part, is people thinking that I have some influence and power that I don't have, you know, and having to let people down and not say, like, yeah, no, like,
it's a tough position.
There's nothing that I can do for you, you know.
It's a tough position to be in. But you know what? Tell you what, I can't thank you enough for the time you've given us with this conversation. I even went overboard a little bit, and genuinely, I wish you nothing but the best of wishes and luck over the next period as you navigate, you know, this experience and this moment in your life. And I look forward to coming out west when I'm back in Canada, so we can meet.
Yeah, let's do that. You're welcome.
Thank you so much, Valerie, and thank you for your time. I appreciate you coming on Real Talk.
Thanks for having me.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's intensifying its campaign to seize Gaza City and forcibly displace its residents. An estimated 1 million people are believed to be sheltering there. Over the weekend, Israeli forces bombed more than 30 residential buildings, as well as several schools and tent encampments.
I was sitting, preparing some food for the children. People came and said that we have to evacuate the school. We took our things and put them outside. Minutes later, they started to strike the school. We only could get what we were wearing. I'm sitting in a tent, nothing left for my children. I have no pillow, no blanket, nothing. Should I sleep in the streets with my children? Where should I go?
Targets struck on Sunday included the Islamic University and the Roya Tower, which housed media and UN offices. Israeli officials claim a quarter of a million Palestinians have left Gaza City in recent days, but residents of the city say there's no safe place to go.
My home, my safety, my life, my whole life has been spent in this house. It's the safety of my children. Now I can no longer feel safe for myself or my home. I don't know where to go. I'm standing here with nowhere to go. I have no place in the south, no place in Gaza. I have found nowhere. Where do we go? Someone please tell us where to go. There is no safe place. Everywhere they say is safe, but the bombing continues and death is everywhere.
Israel killed at least 53 Palestinians Sunday and another 25 so far today, including six-year-old twins. Meanwhile, the number of Palestinians who've starved to death has reached 422. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is in Jerusalem to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The U.S. continues to stand by Israel, despite calling Israel's targeted military strike on Qatar targeting Hamas negotiators last week. The U.S. has called it unhelpful. Five lower-ranking members of Hamas died in the attack in Qatar's capital, Doha. A Qatari security staffer was also killed. We go now to Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, where we're joined by Dr. Mohammed Sakhar. He's director of nursing at Nasser Hospital. Thank you so much for joining us, doctor. If you can describe what's happening right near Nasser Medical Complex, if you can describe what's happening with the displacement of the population from Gaza City.
Yeah. Hi, thanks for having me on your channel. For the current situation now inside Nasser Medical Complex, the current situation really is very catastrophic. Now, for medical staff, as you know, very little amount of food are allowed to enter Gaza City. So most of the medical staff here work in a very bad condition. Most of them are really hungry, and the amount of food is not enough. So all of this staff suffering from moderate or mild malnutrition. For, as you know, it has been a long time, for more than 20 months, working continuously. We are physically really tired and exhausted. And by the way, we can't tolerate any more burden on us. As you know, we are psychologically unstable because we see execution of civilians on a daily basis. Every day we receive in Nasser Medical Complex nearly 100 civilians murdered, whether by tanks or gunshots or snipers. And for the medical staff themselves as well, we are unsafe and we are targeted sometimes even inside the hospital. Last month, the Israeli Air Forces attacked the hospital and killed four of our medical staff. One was a doctor and the other a nurse and two administrative staff inside the complex. So as I have just said, the situation we are working in is very catastrophic, and Israel doesn't respect the international law and regulations, especially when they target us and kill us, even inside the hospital. Let me tell you about the seating capacity of Nasser Medical Complex. Nasser Medical Complex was designed to receive and deal with 350 patients only. Now, the current patients inside the complex is 1,000 patients. So we have no beds. We have to put patients on the ground, no supplies, no instruments. And the things will go worse when the Israeli evacuation orders the Gaza city to come here to Khan Yunis concentration camp. So it will be more and more tragic to deal with such high number of civilians and populations. Actually, let me say something important the world must know. We are here deprived from everything, every human rights. For example, let me say that I don't have the right now to buy a shoes. You know, there are no shoes in the city, for example. So for me, I have just one shoes, sharing it with five of my sons. So if I have now, I have maybe $1,000, but I can't find just one single shoes in the whole city to wear. So I have, sometimes at night, I have to walk barefoot without shoes. Something is happening here, must stop. This genocide must stop. We are deprived from every single human rights. Sister, let me just explain another thing important here. No goes inside the hospital. Sometimes we stop the service of dressing because there is no medical goes to change dressing for patients. That led to spread of infection among many of our patients. Sometimes there are no thermometers. So we try to guess the temperature of patients by palpation and touching the skin of patients in order to guess the temperature of patients. At the time, we don't have CTG machines for fetuses to estimate and measure their heartbeats. Other times, no CBC kits in order to continue lab investigations. The things now inside Gaza Strip and especially in Nasser Medical Complex is really catastrophic and violate every single human rights. And this is really against international laws and regulations. Yeah.
Dr. Mohammed Sakhar, you are the director of nursing at the Nasser Medical Complex. The Al Jazeera is reporting the Palestinian Health Ministry says at least three people died in the last 24 hours from hunger, bringing the total number of people dead due to starvation to 425, including 125 children. And we also have the reports Israeli forces killed five people seeking food in southern Gaza. At least five Palestinians waiting for food were killed by gunfire south of Khan Yunis. What does it mean to treat people who are dying of starvation who have been bombed? I mean, the effect of malnutrition and hunger on the body.
Yeah, as you know, to explain it more for your audience to understand what is happening here, first let's start with the distribution points, food distribution points. The Israeli army threw the cartons of food on the ground and asking the people to come. When they take the cartons of food, they start shooting at them. That's why on a daily basis, we receive 100 or 200 wounded people, sometimes 300 and 400 from that distribution sites. When people come to our emergency department, we have two real crises. The first is the bullets which penetrated their bodies. The second is that the people are really physically deteriorated, you know, deteriorated. They are physically unfit. They are very, very, very malnourished. So you just see people, skin on bones, you know, These people were seeking for just food to feed themselves and their children. And when they attacked by missiles, tanks, missiles, or snipers, bullets, they come here to our emergency department. So we have to deal with two challenges. The first is the injury, and the second is the severe malnutrition they are suffering from. And by the way, maybe you don't have a comprehensive view of what is happening here in Gaza Strip. Now we have three main concentration camps: Khan Yunis concentration camp, and the Middle concentration camp, and Gaza concentration camp. I'm from Khan Yunis concentration camp. This camp is nearly 25 kilometers square, 25 only. The number of population inside this camp is more than 1 million people, more than 1 million people moving only in 25 kilometers. And there is red line. If you cross this line, you will be directly attacked by tanks and military aircrafts. So imagine 1 million or more than 1 million people in just 25 kilometers suffering from severe malnutrition, lack of good healthcare system, spread of infection, a lot of things. So now, on Nasser Medical Complex, really we are in a critical stage now, because we don't know how to focus on wounded, targeted people, malnourished populations, spread of infections. By the way, people here don't find anything to eat. If they find, they find some very minimum amount of food in a very high cost. Really, these concentration camps kill people gradually. And we have made urgent appeal to the international community, please stop this genocide as soon as possible. This is a fight not against Palestinians. This is a fight against humanity all over the world. This must end and stop soon. This is like a shame on humanity to make camps like this, focusing people and concentrating people in like this way, more than 1 million in 25 kilometers, and killing them inside these camps by tanks and aircraft, military aircrafts, killing them inside these camps by snipers, killing these people inside this camp by preventing them from food access and medical access or health care access. This is insane. This madness must stop. Sister, I'm not just sad at what is happening here for Palestinians. I'm really sad at Israelis themselves, because their government is putting them at the darkest side of the history. This must stop. And the international community and General Council must question the Israeli government. Please stop humiliating us. We are not animals to be collected in very poor concentration camps like this, killing us and destroying our houses. And by the way, you know what is what makes these camps? When they destroyed our houses, when they destroyed our hospitals and health facilities, we have no homes, we have no houses, no infrastructure, nothing. So we escaped to the west of the city. Now this camp is 25 kilometers. We are not allowed to pass or cross this camp. If anyone cross, he will be directly targeted. Sister, they have taken away every single human right from us. We are not allowed to eat. We are not allowed to dress. We are not allowed to buy shoes. We are allowed to eat a very minimum amount of food. 2 months ago, we were completely deprived from food, but now, just very minimum amount of food. We are not allowed to wear shoes. We are not allowed to eat vegetables. We are not allowed to eat fruits. We are dying.
Dr. Mohammed Sakhar, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Director of Nursing at the Nasser Medical Complex near Khan Yunis in the south of Gaza.
That's it for us for today. You were listening to Under the Olive Tree.